From National Public Radio, it's Latino USA. Take a listen to this and think about what year you think it was written. Tax dollars should not be used to promote cultural beliefs or values when such values are in conflict with the values of American citizenship and the teachings of Western civilization. It's from Senate Bill 1108, currently pending in Arizona. And my question is, should tax dollars be spent in denying beliefs and values simply because they're, what, different, subversive, un-American? In 1954 on CBS, Edward R. Murrow spoke these words.
We must not confuse dissent with disloyalty. We will not be driven by fear into an age of unreason. And remember, we are not descended from fearful men.
On today's program, we explore the politics of loyalty and dissent in Arizona. I'm Maria Hinojosa. New Jersey's top federal prosecutor has stirred the immigration controversy when he told a Latino group that being undocumented in the United States is not a crime. Joining us to discuss this and other news of the week affecting the Latino community is Univision's national news anchor, María Elena Salinas. Hola, María Elena.
Hi, María. Nice to talk to you.
We've said it a number of times on our show that being undocumented in the United States, in fact, is not illegal. But I guess some people were surprised to hear that from a major federal prosecutor, this one from New Jersey. So what can you tell us about the statements and what kind of uproar they've created?
Well, Maria, you know, it was New Jersey's top federal prosecutor who said it. And it was at a community forum on immigration that was organized by the Latino Leadership Alliance in New Jersey. And his comments were picked up by a local newspaper. He's not talking much about it anymore, though. It was U.S. Attorney Christopher Christie, and according to the reports, he said that living in the country without proper documentation is a civil offense, not a crime. You know, one of the reasons why his comments are surprising is because Christie is perceived as a tough prosecutor, and he's considered a possible Republican candidate for governor in 2009. But it does make sense that he should say that because, you know, remember that Congressman Sessenbrenner introduced a bill that intended to criminalize being undocumented. So obviously, if you wanted to criminalize it, it's because it's not a crime.
But when you cross the border without papers, without proper documentation, in fact, it is just a misdemeanor.
That's what it seems, according to his description. Crossing the border without documents is not committing a crime. Committing a crime, according to the way that is being described here, would be when you work without having a work permit, when you have to actually use false papers or misuse papers or because it's considered identity theft, and when you have violated a rule not to come into the country because you've already been deported in the past.
All right, so this story actually surprised me. The United Farm Workers Union has announced that it will be actively recruiting farm workers from Mexico, this using legal temporary work visas. But that means that the United Farm Workers would actually be working as a kind of foreign recruiter for Mexican workers? I mean, really, this was, to me, jaw-dropping.
Well, yeah, you know, you would think it's a conflict of interest because the United Farm Workers, they want to protect the jobs of farm laborers right here in the country. But things are getting very difficult for them right now because the agricultural industry depends so much on immigrants, and it's estimated that about 70% of them are undocumented, so there's been a shortage of workers. So what they want to do is work together with Mexican authorities and recruit farm workers, getting them visas so that they can work here legally on a temporary basis, and it would be covered under union contracts. They say they want to make sure that farmers give these temporary workers the same rights as U.S. workers, and on the Mexican side, they say that they want to protect them from recruiters that are doing, you know, unscrupulous things like charging them $5,000 to get them a contract. There's still a question of the legality of this recruitment by United Farm Workers. So they're doing it, but we don't know if they're going to be allowed to come in.
Right. It's still up in the air. Okay, María Elena, let's move on to our next story. Governor of New Mexico, a former first Latino running for president of this country, Bill Richardson, he went to Venezuela to try to open up the possible release of American hostages that are held by Colombian rebels known as the FARC. They're being held in Colombia by a Colombian group. Why is he kind of putting himself out there in the spotlight now, and why did he go to Venezuela and not Colombia?
Yeah, that is a little odd, isn't it? You know, I guess he wants to negotiate with the negotiator, and Colombia has a standing policy not to negotiate with terrorists, and the FARC is considered a terrorist group. Up to now, really, the release of the hostages that have been let go have been a result of negotiations between the rebels and President Hugo Chavez. But, you know, things have changed since then. There's more tension between Colombia and Venezuela, and Colombia no longer is letting Chavez get in. Now, where does Richardson come into all this? Well, what he claims is that the families of three of the hostages, which are three American citizens that have been held for about 5 years now, the families asked Richardson to get involved. So that's why he says that he went to meet with Chavez on behalf of the families of those three Americans. Chavez has said in the past that he lost contact with the people he had been talking to because of some of the rebel leaders that have been killed. That's the next step, you know, to see if anything was actually accomplished, if it was just a very odd photo op between Richardson and Chavez.
Thanks, Maria Elena. We'll talk to you again next week.
Okay, Maria. Take care.
Maria Elena Salinas is a syndicated columnist and national news anchor for Univision, the Spanish-language television network. It's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. In Arizona, legislation is currently being debated that seeks to limit what public schools and universities can include in their curricula. Senate Bill 1108 would ban teachings that are, quote, counter to democracy and Western civilization, or that encourage dissent. But educators and students across the state have sounded alarms about the proposal, saying that the law is really targeting Chicano student organizations and ethnic studies classes. From KJZZ Radio in Phoenix, Marcos Najera has our story.
Senate Bill 1108 would allow the state superintendent of public instruction to withhold public dollars from any school that teaches values that could be interpreted as critical of Western civilization or any American citizen. Republican Representative Russell Pierce sponsored the measure.
To me, this is a very, very important bill. And when we talk about American values, about organizations that spew anti-American or race-based, they have no place. We ought to be celebrating unity as Americans.
Pierce chairs the Arizona House Appropriations Committee. 2 weeks ago at this session, Pierce convinced the members of the committee to approve an amendment to a routine Homeland Security bill. The original bill has nothing to do with education, but instead it would simply allow people designated by mayors and police chiefs to serve on Homeland Security advisory councils. But now, the bill declares that the purpose of Arizona's public education system is to teach strictly American values.
These organizations that spew anti-American rhetoric, that taxpayer dollars is inappropriate.
Pierce, a lawmaker from a conservative community east of Phoenix called Mesa, penned the amendment in response to Raza Studies, courses that teach about Mexican-American history and activism that are currently being taught in Tucson schools.
I have a petition with a bunch of students that have signed it down in Tucson schools protesting Raza teachings, which have been directed specifically. It's a very anti-American hate speech and paid for by tax dollars. In fact, it's sedition in reality. They advocate the elimination of borders and the takeover of Southwest United States. Well, you know, freedom of speech, I appreciate that, but not the taxpayer dollars. I think the Constitution is very clear that those elements are inappropriate.
The bill would also prohibit any student at a state university or community college from forming a group based on race, like MECHA, or a campus chapter of the National Society of Black Engineers, just to name a few examples.
It's a flat-out racist piece of legislation. I don't think that it should exist, but unfortunately it does, so we have to do something about it.
Miguel Zarate is a junior majoring in economics at Arizona State University. The 27-year-old immigrant from Mexico enrolled at ASU after serving several years in the Navy. He's the leader of ASU's El Concilio, which is a consortium of all Latino student groups on campus. Last week, Zarate wrote to State Representative Russell Pierce on behalf of the coalition, requesting a meeting.
I sent him an email just to see what kind of a reaction I would get from him, see if I would actually receive any kind of earnest dialogue. But actually, he sent me a a copy and paste email that he was sending out to any individual that contacts him about Senate Bill 1108.
In a somewhat jumbled email response he sent to Zarate, Pierce explained how Senate Bill 1108 would, quote, end hate speech and the such on our campuses and the abuse of our system, which is an affront to our way of life, end quote. Pierce goes on to cite passages from a Chicano activist speech called Kill the Gringo. While members of El Concilio gathered this week to organize a forum about the measure, some state education advocates are calling the bill's merit into question.
When you look at the language, it's going to be just about impossible to enforce with any kind of conscience.
Andrew Morrill is the vice president of the Arizona Education Association. The AEA is a professional organization that started more than a century ago, during a time when teachers were demanding that outdated textbooks get replaced.
As long as we are not going to teach controversy, conflict, dissent, diverse opinion, we can probably go ahead and operate under the tight scope and focus that this would seem to establish. The minute we start to talk about the more complex and therefore the more enriching issues and conflict that are inherent anytime a people try to govern themselves, try to live together, try to incorporate the very diversity that makes this country unique, it's simply unworkable.
The state's full House and Senate must still take a final vote on Senate Bill 1108, but first the measure will be heading back to caucus. In the meantime, many student groups at ASU and local community colleges are banding together to stage local protests. For Latino USA, I'm Marcos Najera in Phoenix.
For more now on this, we turn to Rodolfo Acuña. Dr. Acuña is one of the foremost scholars of Chicano studies, and he's the author of Occupied America, A History of Chicanos. Welcome to Latino USA, Professor Acuña.
Thank you very much.
So we just heard a story from Arizona, and our reporter was talking about state legislators who are seeking to define the curriculum of public schools as having to, quote, inculcate the values of American citizenship. And it would also ban any teachings that, quote, encourage dissent or disparages these values. Professor Acuña, first of all, as an academic, when you hear this kind of legislation being discussed, what goes on for you?
Well, it just reminds me of what happened in history. It reminds me of the McCarthy era and the lynch mob mentalities in the 19th century here in the Southwest that saw almost 600 Mexicans lynched.
Your own book, Occupied America, which is read across the country, and it's been named as perhaps a book that could possibly be banned from schools if this legislation goes through. Essentially, it's a history of the Southwest from a perspective of the Mexican-American community. So what does this mean to you?
They don't want to deal with the truth. They want to deal with what they believe to be the truth and with what they want you to think, because it's not a Mexican-American book. It's a history book. It's a book that wants to discover the truth of what history is, what happened in the past.
So why this disconnect between what's considered the mainstream version of the history of the Southwest and a Chicano perspective on this history? How could this possibly be seen as somehow un-American to be teaching different perspectives about a history that was commonly shared?
They want to teach a elementary school version of history. They want to teach a version of history that has a paradigm where the United States makes no errors. And history is something that is supposed to be critical. There's supposed to be a certain skepticism to history. And Chicano history is no different than well-written U.S. history that is critical of society and critical of the past.
If this legislation goes through in Arizona, it would also ban any organization that is based in whole or in part on race-based criteria. So, for example, organizations like MECHA, a Chicano students organization, the Black Business Students, the Native American Student Association, all of these organizations could be targeted. Some people might say, look, why do we need these organizations if we're a society where there isn't racism, where we're all equal? So why do we need these groups?
When I got here at Cal State Northridge in 1969, we only had about 50 students of Mexican extraction. Today we have around 11,000 Latinos, and we've made progress because of groups like MECHA, because they have gotten out there, they have made demands, and they have gone out and recruited. Mecha just held a conference right now for high school students, and they had about 300 students, and they were encouraging them, come to school, don't join gangs, come to the university. So to me, it's beyond belief that these people can malign 18-year-old kids. I mean, you look at their little faces, and you really get upset.
Some might say that this is just an isolated case of a small group of legislators in one particular state pushing one very narrow agenda. Is this the way that you see it, or is there a larger context that you think we need to know about?
There's a larger context. I think that one of the things that scares me is that it encourages other kooks. You know, the anti-immigrant hysteria has grown tremendously in the last 20 years. And one of the reasons it has grown is because people follow the leader. They follow the people who are expressing their fears, expressing their hatreds. And here in the United States, many times, angst sells.
Rodolfo Acuña, thank you so much for joining us on Latino USA.
Thank you very much.
Rodolfo Acuña is a professor of Chicano studies at California State University at Northridge. He's the author of Occupied America, A History of Chicanos.
I would not be a best-selling author, community activist, or national and international poet and speaker if it weren't for my ties to Mecha, the Chicano student organization.
For commentator Luis Rodriguez, joining Mecha wasn't about dissent. It was his path to empowerment.
I joined Mecha in the fall of 1972 when I attended LA's California State University. Prior to this, I was a drug addict and gang member, in and out of schools and jails for most of my teens. The late 1960s and early 1970s brought a level of activism, study, and pride to many disenfranchised and neglected communities. This included East LA, the largest Mexican community in the country. I was fortunate to be one of the lost youth who were saved by the organized struggles to bring justice, equity, and dignity to this community. Mecha was key to this. The organization proclaimed that Chicanos, like all people, have a right to exist, to have their true history and accomplishments recognized, and to be counted. I edited the Mecha newspaper that later served to boost my life as a professional journalist and essayist. I also organized the East LA High Schools for Mecha. This community had the most overcrowded schools with some of the highest dropout rates. Mecha helped turn this around by providing college preparation and a community to assist students every step of the way. Mecha has never hurt or threatened anybody to achieve these aims. They embody the spirit of the 60s by organizing events, forums, protests, and more against injustices and for the inclusion of everyone. They know that the United States is a complex and multi-layered country. We all belong. And we can all be accepted for who we are, regardless of religion, race, culture, and disabilities. What Arizona's attempted to do by outlawing these organizations is counter to any decent ideal this country possesses. We need to unite around the essential things we all care about, like the well-being of our children and youth, and allow full freedom about the non-essential aspects, such as what people eat, what faith they believe in, or how they celebrate their families and cultures. Mecha is not a danger to this country. Intolerant politicians who can't see the humanity of anyone unless they act or look like them is. The homogenizing of America is wrong. Keep America free and united by safeguarding organizations like Mecha.
In a minute, embarking on a journey, a young Latina starts a new life at college. Coming up on Latino USA, no se vayan.
We'll be right back.
You're listening to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. It's San Diego, 1973. 18-year-old Yolanda Sahagún can't wait to move into the college dorms and leave the small house she shares with 10 other family members behind. For her, she thinks if only she could see the world past her traditional upbringing, she could really discover who she really is. That is, if she can stop feeling guilty about leaving her family behind. For many young Latinos now, the story hasn't changed much. In her latest novel, Ghosts of El Grullo, author Patricia Santana clues us into what's happening with the story of Yolanda Sahagún, and she's here to join us on Latino USA.
Thank you.
Why was it important for you to write this story? I mean, it's a story that really looks at what happens. I mean, there are many things that happen in this book, but it really looks at what happens to young Latinos when they make their way, finally, this huge prize to make it to college. And college, you know, is not necessarily the easy step for a lot of these kids. So why'd you want to write this book?
For exactly that reason. I think there's a sense of what is possible for immigrant children, but also some of the obstacles, and to be aware of them and to somehow find your way through it and not be overwhelmed. And, of course, there's the obstacles of the cultural differences, coming from the sheltered barrio and then suddenly being in an environment that you're not acquainted with.
Your main character, Yolanda Sahagún, is from the San Diego region, ends up going to school in the San Diego region. But I'm thinking about the young Chicanos and Chicanas that I met when I was first starting college in New York. This is the early 1980s. Their families, for many of these young Latinos, were not their greatest source of support. In fact, they made it to college, but really kind of standing up against their parents and saying, I can do this, I can leave home, and I can move to New York and go to college. And a lot of the times the parents were like, don't leave and you won't make it.
Oh, absolutely. And actually, I had a similar situation happen because I had a recruiter from Yale University called me up at home and said, we want you. We want you to apply. We've seen your grades and we've talked to your counselors. You'd be perfect. And so I asked my older sister, well, what should I do? And she said, oh, no, that's way too far away. No, don't do it. And so I didn't apply.
And, oh, my God, that's so sad.
Yeah. But interestingly, even though I stayed in San Diego, truly it was like being in a whole different world. I needed to find a family on campus, and that was Mecha. And I mentioned that in my novel, that they were similar to my family at home, and I still needed that on campus. People, Chicanos who had come from my background, who understood my struggle.
So what happens in the story? Yolanda's mom passes away unexpectedly, and then everything changes. Give us a peek into what happens then.
Then what happens is it seems like the family falls apart. The father sells the house, even though there are still three young daughters in the home. And really what happens is this is as far as he can go without Yolanda's mother at his side. And they all soon realize this to different degrees. All of the siblings realize that, no, he really isn't the strong patriarchal man without the mother. And this was his way of dealing with the death.
So she decides to go back to the hometown in Mexico called El Grullo. What did you want Yolanda to kind of discover when she makes the return trip back to her homeland in Mexico?
I wanted her to try to discover who her mother really was, because her mother died just as she's becoming an adult, a young woman. And that's really about the time that daughters begin to relate to the mother. And so she thought maybe in El Grullo there would be answers that would help her become a woman and make better choices in her life. And of course, what happens in the course of the novel is that she realizes that there is a lot of depth and layers to her father, too.
Patricia Santana, thank you so much for joining us on Latino USA.
It's my pleasure.
Patricia Santana is author of Ghosts of El Grullo,
published by the University of New Mexico Press.
Radio Habana, Cuba, transmitiendo de los estudios de Capitol en Los Ángeles. Cachao y su descarga, mambo con mucho swing.
And finally this week, we want to take a moment to pay tribute to Cuban bassist Israel López, known to his friends and his fans as Cachao. In 1938, Cachao, along with his brother Orestes, wrote a song that would come to define a generation of dancers worldwide. It was called Mambo. A prodigy, Cachao made his musical debut at the age of 13 with the Havana Symphony Orchestra. By the late 1930s, Cachao and Orestes were heading up the top dance band in Cuba, playing danzones, which is a descendant of European court dances. But the brothers felt that their music needed modernizing, and so they added improvisation and Afro-Cuban elements, and the mambo was born. Cachao led some of the most important recordings of Afro-Cuban music in the 1960s, known simply as descargas, or jam sessions. He emigrated to the United States in 1962, and after a few years of success, he fell into a period of obscurity. But thanks to actor and musician Andy Garcia, Cachao came into new fame in his later years, winning Grammys and inspiring an entire new generation of dancers and musicians. Cachao passed away on March 22nd at his home in Coral Gables, Florida, pero todavía sigue la música de Cachao. Latino USA was produced this week by Walter Morgan, Benjamin Jacob, Angela Maldonado, and Alex Avila. Our executive producer is Sean Collins. We had help this week from Georgia Public Broadcasting. To listen to our podcasts, go to latinousa.org or look for us on iTunes. Our listener comment line is 800-535-5533. Our email address is lusa@npr.org. Production support for Latino USA comes from KUT Radio, the Center for Mexican American Studies, the University of Texas at Austin, and the William and Salome Scanlon Foundation of Austin and San Antonio. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next week for NPR's Latino USA.
Support for NPR comes from the Gruber Family Foundation for support of NPR's international coverage. Lumber Liquidators, hardwood, bamboo, and cork flooring. Catalog at 1-800-FLOORING. And Walden University, graduate degrees online for professionals who strive to make a difference. Walden University, a higher degree, a higher purpose. WaldenU.edu. This is NPR, National Public Radio.